Thank you so much for coming. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and it's my privilege to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, which is our weekly lecture series. In celebration of the Modern's 10th year in our beautiful Tadao Ando building, several of the Tuesday evening's lectures are going to feature artists represented in the museum's collection. Tonight we begin this focus with artist Nicholas Nixon, whose ongoing photographic series, The Brown Sisters, begun in 1975, is among the Modern's most beloved works. Beloved, in fact, I'm sure, by many of you, which is what has brought you here tonight. And for those who are new to this annual photographic record of the artist's wife and three sisters, you are sure to join in with the camp of those who love this photograph after tonight's lecture. And you should know that because you are going to be in love with it, you should know that for your regular visits, it's on the first floor in Gallery 5. That's where you'll find it when you go looking for it. In addition to our beloved Brown sisters, Nicholas Nixon is recognized for the ease and intimacy of his large format photographs, gaining broad attention in the 1970s. With work included in the seminal New Topographics, Photographs of a Man-Altered Landscape at the George Eastman House in 1975, and an early solo exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1976. And most recently, in 2010, the Museum of Fine Arts Boston organized a solo exhibition, Nicholas Nixon Family Album, an exploration of a vast range of subjects, including the changing urban landscape in and around Boston and the people who live there, as well as an intimate but documentary-like approach to photographing family, paired with a command of his craft, has earned Nicholas a successful career, including three NEA and two Guggenheim fellowships. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Nicholas here to discuss various photographic projects with our own chief curator, Michael Opping, who has followed the work of Nicholas for more than 30 years and is responsible for this museum's acquiring of the Brown sisters. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Nicholas Nixon and Michael Opping.
My guess is that everyone here wants to hear Nick talk about the Brown sisters. And it is one of the most popular works in our collection. When I put it up, people come. When I take it down, they complain. And usually when people come up to me and say, thank you so much for putting up the Nick Nixon photographs, I walk away and secretly I say, I don't get it. What is the big deal? It's four women. We don't know their first name. We don't know anything about them. What is it that, you know, that makes people so attracted to these images? Well, obviously there's something. But what I want to do tonight, and Nick has indulged me in allowing me to just put together some images about his career. And what I want to do is try to put the Brown sisters in context. To my mind, the Brown sisters is like a heartbeat. Kind of runs through the work,
yeah.
But the body is like doing a whole bunch of other stuff that I think some people might not be aware of. So I want to start with this. This is a photograph from 1975 that you took of your office. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, it may be useless for me to have put this up, but is there anything in this that would indicate who Nicholas Nixon is?
Oh, yeah. I think I might have even thought about that. There's Gardner's Civil War sketchbook. There's Robert Frost. Mm-hmm. And there's Walker Evans' print that a fellow, one of his printers gave me as a gift. And there's Thomas Aikens. Mm-hmm. Portrait of a young school teacher, I think. So, you know, those were all the things I love. My desk still looks kind of like that. I still have the same kind of radio. You know, and there's still the same light. So I'd like to have around things that kind of seem
Well, you talk about, see, I couldn't, in this image, I couldn't really tell which the books, what the books were. But I do know that you graduated with a degree in English literature from the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And then decided somehow to become a photographer. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about that transition.
Okay. I was working in a bookstore, mostly earning my way, and when people weren't around, it was a really nice bookstore that had a lot of art books, and when people weren't around, I'd look at the art books especially. And I started to look, I think I even saw The Family of Man. You know, I'm ashamed in some ways to say it, it was corny, but it was moving. But then I started to look at Cartier-Bresson, and I started to get interested. So the university let normal people who weren't art students take courses in the summer. So the summer between my senior and junior year, I signed up for a course, and the first day, that was it. That was it. I had $300 in the bank. I went out, and I spent $270 of it on a Leica, and I didn't even know that the Leica was Cartier-Bresson's camera. I just liked the look of it.
Wow.
And ever since, I mean, it's just like, strike of lightning. The process, what it does, how it represents things, everything about it. And I feel, this is a little boring to you guys maybe, but there was no future in it. Unless you were going to turn pro and photograph, if you're in Michigan, you photograph cars or weddings. There was no future in what I, sort of was interested in. Walker Evans, was alive at the time and probably selling 2 prints a year. And probably, 100 people in the country knew how good he was. And other than that, he was, not really that much in people's minds. So just everything changed in about 10 years. And I sort of was just lucked out being at the beginning of it.
And then to kind of complete the narrative, you got a degree in photography in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And then got a job teaching in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is sort of where I come into your work, which is you start taking these smallish photographs,
mm-hmm.
as I remember, of Boston, of the city of Boston. And I've always been curious about these, how they relate. I can create a narrative throughout your work in regards to a certain sense of humanity and this and that, but these images, if you could talk about these, and I've always wanted to have a logical explanation for them.
Well, somehow, if you grow up in Detroit and get to live in Boston, it's pretty thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty thrilling to think I actually, get to live here. We kind of chose it. We both went there. We both found reasonable work pretty soon, Bibi and I. In New Mexico, I'd been climbing up on hills and using a handheld speed graphic to photograph looking down. Sort of, they looked kind of like Robert Adams, but further, the things were even further away. And so I would just basically, as a way to sort of celebrate and look at this new city that was my home, I went all around and climbed up on everything. I did not know at the time that was the Henry Richardson Church. I just knew it was beautiful, turned this, late 19th century architecture. And at the time, the Hancock Building, the big tall tower on the right, was, does it? It matters where I have my face, huh?
Yeah. Apparently.
Which is better, this, or that?
The first one?
That's right there, right?
How about that?
Good.
Okay. So I just climbed around and I went to all the squares and all the public places in Boston so I could learn about it. And it's tremendous fun being up high. All the danger, all the wind, all the, whether you have to go to the bathroom or not, all that just goes away when you look on the glass. And you're just up there and you make the best picture you can.
And how did you get so high? And this is Manhattan.
Yeah, that's on the top of Rockefeller Center. I just would talk guys into letting me on the roof.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's pretty high.
Yeah, it's 48 stories, I think. I was high up.
Well, I decided I would throw in a photograph by Alfred Stieglitz from 1936.
Right.
And I do it for a couple of reasons. One is to ask you, were you aware of these and did that influence you in any way? And this is of New York as well. This is of, I forget the name of the building. It was, he was photographing New York.
The Shelton Hotel.
That's it. Thank you. The Shelton Hotel.
Yeah, I was aware of them, but I wasn't conscious. In fact, if I looked at that picture at the time, I would have said, I don't like it because there's no shadow detail. When I was right. when I was up looking at the Lucian Freud show, I noticed how beautiful his shadows are. Mm-hmm. Everything has full information. Photography, you know, oftentimes doesn't, and usually it doesn't because people don't know how to do it. You know, so once in a great while, there's a reason for a picture to have big black area and there's nothing in it, no detail. But most of the time, it's just a failure. Why not show the shadows? Why, it's sort of like a metaphor. Why not show everything? Why not show the dark side as well as the bright side and show everything so the viewer trusts you? If you don't have that, the brightness doesn't mean much. So at the time, I probably would have looked at this and said, yeah, that's nice, but I like his other ones better because it hasn't got any shadow detail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, photographer nerd.
I chose this one because to compare to yours, because this one seems to be about surface and light.
Yeah.
And where yours, and you feel free, all the speakers correct me all the time, but yours seem to be about light penetrating the space more.
Yeah.
And where he is really about using these large industrial images to catch the light, yours penetrates it. And this is Wall Street. This is an image by Nick of Wall Street in New York. Were you interested in architecture?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I did a year as an architectural photographer's assistant before I got married.
Oh, well, see, I didn't know that.
And decided I didn't like it because it was too much about money and, you know, making buildings look beautiful when they weren't.
Okay. That actually completely explains the architecture photographs to me.
Yeah.
Which that aspect I didn't.
Yeah, the guy hired me because he wanted some young guy to kind of question him and challenge him. And so it was a nice year, but I just ended up. They don't care about the picture, they just care about their product looking good. And to me, that was like turning a trick or something at the time. It right. seemed really, low.
So then you start taking photographs outside of what I would call the city center.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of ringing, I'm assuming this is, I don't know where all these are, but I'm assuming they're ringing around
right
Boston. But
5 miles.
5 miles out, but the edge of a city, not the interior of a city. And these are the photographs that I would associate with what Terry was talking about, the new topographics,
mm-hmm.
which was very big for young curators like myself, who knew Louis Baltz and Stephen Shore. And you were in that show. Mm-hmm. Both of those artists were in that show. And I show this. It was actually Stephen Shore and Louis Baltz. This is a photograph by Stephen Shore, which is very, to my mind, similar to your photograph. And the thing about the new topographics that always was interesting to me was that you guys somehow found a way of taking a photograph of something that was of no interest,
mm-hmm.
Or it appeared to be of no interest, and I had to look for what interested you. This is a photograph by Louis Baltz, who did a lot of photographs of industrial buildings in Los Angeles in the 1970s. This is a photograph by Robert Adams, who was also in the New Topographics show. So I'm just trying to put you in context.
We were friends at this point. Adams,
you were.
Yeah.
So
still are.
I would love to hear what you thought, because it was a very big deal, this new topographic show. I didn't see it. Most of us didn't see it, but we heard about it, and it was the first time that photography, it was the first time that contemporary photography actually seemed contemporary, because it was photographing really contemporary things. But what was your view of new topographics?
Well, it was my first big group show, so I was proud of it. You know, I was really happy to be in it. My friend Robert was in it, and I don't know even why they asked me exactly. But it was my city pictures, not with people in them. Go back
right.
a couple. I want to make something clear to the kid under the street. See, the reason I took this next picture...
We're going to show this again.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, because well, that's sort of part of the narrative. The thing that I really wanted to hear, I mean, I know you would like to have been in that show, but did you have a theory of what the new topographics was about?
Yeah, my theory was that you wanted to get your opinion and your feelings as far down as possible and use your mind and use your sense of what was absolutely true outside of your own preconceptions. It was an attempt to try to sort of almost clinically depict something without aspect, without too much opinion, because the idea was, I think I even said in the catalog, the world is more interesting than whenever I think.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get to what some chunk of the world is without what I think about it getting in the way, that would be interesting. And I think that kind of attitude had something in common with most of the people in the show.
Right. It took me 30 years to figure out what was the difference between you and the new topographics. And the difference, to my mind, was... I'm sorry, we're going to have to go through a couple of other things, because I think a lot of the people in the new topographic show were influenced by Walker Evans.
Oh, we all loved it.
Loved Walker Evans. These are photographs of Walker Evans from the mid-1930s. And you can see how Baltz and Robert Adams and Nick would be interested. But what I think distinguished you, Nick, I finally figured out, was that there were people in yours.
Oh, yeah, that's all I was interested in.
But there weren't people in any of the other photographs.
Well, this was later. This
was 77.
This came after the building picture stopped.
Right.
I got bored with buildings, and I was trying to figure out how to photograph people.
Right.
And so they were only small, because I hadn't figured out how to photograph them bigger yet. So this is kind of like a figure and landscape problem, right, where the frame already exists and the people are sort of little incidental, nice details. The guy under the car was great. But very quickly it became, and this next picture that I see you have is the same thing. The picture, I could have probably set the picture up ahead of time if I wanted to and just waited for the people to come in.
Right.
As it was kind of a quick flash, but the people were far away, so it was easy to manage. I didn't have to talk to them. I didn't have to convince them about everything. They were so small, they were far away. But pretty soon, it got more interesting. But I had to do it to find out how to do it. So I was out doing it every day for years.
Well, the thing also that I think really distinguishes your work, and from many photographers, not just the new topographics, is that... the moments of tenderness, and there is a sentiment to your photographs which is really antithetical to a lot of contemporary art.
And the new topographics.
And the new, oh, for
I
sure.
Changed. The I new, just changed.
But, you know, and it is this sense that as you brought people in, you became more engaged with the people. I mean, I can't think of a contemporary artist that would do a photograph of a man hugging his dog. You know, it particularly at this stage. And if I think about it and I compare it with what was going on in the late 70s, if you put it in the context of Cindy Sherman, you know, who is really, the great thing about Cindy Sherman is that it's all about self-obsession. It's all about self. It's all about self-image. It's about the me generation. How can I look this way or act this way? But it's not about other people, where your photographs become about, eventually, relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just people.
That be sharper? You need to see her eyeballs.
Exactly. Her eyes are, I mean, it's like you're a predator who's just come upon the...
Can the focus maybe be a little cleaner? Somebody back there?
He's working on it.
He'll work on it.
It may be. I probably scanned this image, and so it's not going to be.
I'm getting shaky, huh?
Yeah, this is my fault.
It's okay.
But what is the context of this? I mean, I know that...
I'm walking around with the camera over my shoulder on a river near me that I love, the Charles River.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a while I was even thinking of it being a group of pictures called the Charles River or something like that. But a lot of my ideas like that are just pretexts for being in place to make something happen about something that I don't know about that's terrific. So they're just a pretext to sort of get there and get the game going. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, if it's about the Charles River, the longer it stays just being about the Charles River, the duller it is. Mm-hmm. The more it jumps off from there someplace that I couldn't have predicted ahead of time, the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's so much fun when I get to do, because it's because that happens every day with everything, I mean, picture-wise.
So does that somewhat explain, Nick, you've done these pictures, a lot of pictures, I don't know how many, of people on porches.
Yeah.
I mean, that becomes, to me, it's a really interesting subgenre within the history of photography that someone decided that I want to take photographs of people on porches because porches are this interesting space between being private and being public.
Mm-hmm. You said an interesting thing earlier about Lucian Freud and him. Sometimes one of the reasons he painted himself was because he was available.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's good about porches is people are available.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just the sense at the time, there was a sense of affection and sort of close stuff happening that you could actually be a guest if you were polite. You could actually go up and speak to them and ask to take their picture, and it wasn't rude. In fact, it was welcome. You know, you send them a picture, and it's a nice experience for me, and it's a nice experience for them. So porches were, you know, I mean, the practical thing was they were. It was kind of a setup. They were there, and I was moved by them. I was moved by their grace and by their togetherness. And so it was kind of, you know, sort of ready-made. It was a nice graphic, too, because there wasn't too much. The stuff behind them was interesting to make shapes of. You know, it wasn't trees or sky or skyscrapers. It was, you know, windows and doors and things that mean something. Things that not only are good to play with visually, but things that have significance. Doors and windows, things you come out of, things you hide behind, things you, you know, come through. And so they're kind of loaded.
The one thing about them, though, and I've looked at a lot of them, that amazes me is that they never seem posed. Because you've set up the scenario, you're walking down the street, you have your camera, you see some people, they kind of see you, hi, how are you? Somehow you insinuate yourself up there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're up there, and one would expect that everybody go, oh, the guy with the camera's here, let's pose. But these never seem posed. So how do you do that? How do you get it so it actually seems like there wasn't a photographer there? I mean, this doesn't feel like a photographer was there. This feels like we were just there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think the answer is I finally figured out it's something to do with me. I'm good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I didn't have photography, you know, and was young and handsome, I could be a great seducer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, first of all, I always find something I like.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, this was happening. Mm-hmm. This exact thing was happening. So usually, I just say, wow, can we just take it like we were, please?
Mm-hmm.
So they get that I liked what I saw, mm-hmm. and they give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it gets better. Sometimes this kid...
But they're, know, so they're not snapshots.
No. No, they're not. Can you hold that for a minute?
Really?
Can you hold that quickly? Yeah.
Okay.
Or let's do another, you know, or, oh, wow, right. Come on, get over on the right. Oh, come on, it all happens very fast, and sometimes things change that are better than what I could have seen from the street, and I have to be totally open to that or I'm a dope.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, if the thing I see is good, but it changes and gets better, I mean, how terrific is that? So that's really part of the fun. Usually it's better. Probably what attracted me here was the old lady. She was sitting there like a queen. I came back actually the next year, to the same place. They had the picture on their wall. I'd sent it to them. And the woman on the left, sat in the new place now because the old lady had died.
Oh.
And her daughter had taken her place. She was the one who sat in the in the place. So it was very sweet.
Right.
You know, she was old and time to die, I guess.
Just over the last few weeks, going through a lot of the books on your work, one of the things I noticed, eventually it just jumped out at me, that a ton of your photographs are just about touching. People touching. It's like, you know, you see it in different series. It's not just, there is no series called Touching, but I mean, this is...
I love this picture. Nobody else does.
This is such a tender, unbelievable thing. But the touching thing is like everywhere in your images. When you do images of couples... I mean, it's like, so I just find it really interesting. Even when it's a brother trying to smash his little brother's fingers, it's still about touching. Still about touching.
Yeah, that just happened. I was really quick. See, part of what was happening in this process was I have this big camera, and I was learning how to use it fast. And so each year I'd get a little faster and a little smoother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could, by the time this was happening at the end of these, I could just set it right down in the right place, look through, quick check, and take it all in like 5 seconds. And that was really fun to get good at it.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in that anymore, but I was really interested in that at the time. You know, the game, the sort of like playing scales with a violin or something, you know, just the physical part and having that be something that honored the world better than if I was crummy at it was, you know, just tremendously exhilarating.
Hmm.
And when it stopped being interesting, and when I stopped getting, when I thought I was as good as I could get it, that particular way of making a picture, I did something else.
Hmm. And then you did a series of couples, and which is, I mean, the segue from touching is to go into couples. And not only did you do a series, and this is what has always amazed me about your work, is as contemporary art gets more theoretical and more conceptual, here's a guy who does a bunch of pictures about kissing. Really? Kissing?
Oh, yeah.
And then you look at these pictures about kissing, and you realize what is so bizarre about a photograph of kissing is that you never think of kissing as static. At least I don't.
No,
because
you
know, I'm always trying to make that next move. But you know what I mean? I mean, it's like you're moving around, your mouth's moving around, and yet a photograph of kissing is like touching in its most extreme and sort of tenuous way.
Go back one. The two pictures make an interesting point to that. See, I'm not using a flash there, and these guys really like having their picture taken, and we're getting along really well. So they had to hold that for me for half a second. So that's actually staged of what they were doing.
Really?
But the next one. But when you use flash, like in the one before and the one after it, then you can just do it fast, and you can sort of snatch the moment the way you would if you had a little camera. So you know, that's just a quick moment that happened because of flash. As was the one two before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you shouldn't have to know about that. The picture is just about the picture, but you know, and I have to be adjustable. I have to be flexible given the people and the light situation and mostly the psychological situation between me and them. How we get along, it's like friendship or something. It's everything about how we relate and how we trust each other. A lot of this is about trust. Because I don't lie to them, I think they trust me. And because I usually start off with something I like. I told these guys I thought they looked like two planets.
Well, they do. And this is like a kiss that just doesn't look like it's working. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I've done plenty of those with my life. And,
men are, it's the old thing. It's like the man doesn't want to be intimate in front of me, and the woman is fine with it. And so she's into it, and he's holding back.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I like about the picture.
I couldn't resist comparing these two. Because there are these images of couples, and so on the left is a Nick Nixon photograph of two bodies entangled, and a Lucian Freud painting that is upstairs of two bodies entangled. And I just thought it'd be interesting to talk about the difference between portrait painting and portrait photography, because they're both about time, but they're about time in completely different ways. Like Lucian's pictures are about painting someone over 8 months. And so there's a time element that maybe you can perceive if you look at these paintings. That's why they look like they look, because they were painted over 8 months. But a photograph is about time in the most condensed sense. It's like... And so, but there's probably another element of time. It's like, how long does it take you to photograph that? Not how long does it take the shutter to move, but how long does it take you to figure out?
Fast.
Really?
Because if it's good, it's not going to stay there long.
Right.
And because I don't have the kind of imagination that a painter does to imagine what it would look like until it sees it, till I see it. So the time between when I see it and I take the picture has to be short, or the thing will go away. So I have to be kind of like a hunter. but right. also kind and honest and all that at the same time. So I had to see that, and I don't even remember if I asked them to hold it or not. I think they were just hugging, and I could take whatever I wanted. But you hope that the picture is good enough that it stand, that it is about a specific moment, but it stands for something more.
Mm-hmm.
The good ones do. The good one stands for something about two guys, you know, and a hug. And it's, so it's not just about a single moment, even though it is of a single moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing that interests me about the process is that when Lucien paints, if he paints over 8 months, he gets to internally edit the whole time he's painting, right? Mm-hmm. So I paint mm-hmm. this, ah, didn't mm-hmm. work so good, do this, do that. Mm-hmm. So your editing either has to take place instantaneously, or do you take a lot of photographs and then edit?
No, I take a few and then edit.
And then
usually
edit.
Of this, I'd probably take two or three, and there'd be one that would be good, hopefully.
Okay.
And there'd be one that would be almost, and I'd keep it around. And there'd one that would be stupid, and I'd throw that away.
Okay. But you take very few.
I take very few, yeah.
Because
the film's,
or it
the film's
work.
Expensive. I can only carry, without a car, I can only carry 12 pictures around with me easily. So I have 12 sheets of film with me, and so I don't want to waste them.
I got it.
So
it's good point.
But that's fun, too, to try to figure, you know, it's like a game. It's really fun to be as efficient as you can
right.
with the small means, like a, you know, tennis court or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is interesting.
But the time thing, that's why people like the Brown sisters, I think, is because the time period is long. The time mm-hmm. period is, you know, longer than a moment. It's
true.
It's bigger even than a painting.
Yeah. It's a whole bunch of little instances that add up to a whole lot of time.
Yeah.
But let's hold that, because we'll show those at the end.
Okay.
And then you did this remarkable series, and I remember when you did these on people with AIDS. And, you know, there's a number of ways to look at these pictures of people with AIDS. But I remember thinking, in the early 80s, I mean, the AIDS epidemic broke out in the very early 80s. And I was near Atlanta at the time, and the Center for Disease Control was there. And there was a lot of mystery about it, what this disease is, what it does, how you can catch it. And, well, there's great compassion in these photographs of yours. My first thought was, gosh, he's spending all of these time with AIDS patients. He could get AIDS. And you didn't think of that. Was that...
I knew enough science to know there was nonsense.
Okay.
I'm not going to have sex with them or
right.
put a cut up next to their cut. You know.
Well, that's true.
There's nothing to it.
And what I'm speaking of is in the early 80s, and these were done beginning around 85? 86. Mm-hmm. 85, 6. That's what I thought.
So the science was pretty clear, I think.
It was certainly getting a lot clearer
yeah.
at that time. But they're so... And this is another thing that seems anathema to contemporary art, and everybody could disagree with me and say you're wrong. But, you know, the element of compassion in your photographs, you don't see it a lot in contemporary art. You see a great deal of intelligence. You see a great deal of daring. But you don't see the kind of compassion that these photographs impart to me. Or I don't see it. Maybe other people do.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I knew all these people, and I was very moved by them, and felt great affection. Sure,
you knew all.
I photographed them repeatedly over, you know, mm-hmm. over months. So this guy, for example, his father's a doctor. He's a doctoral student at the Kennedy School in Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Smart. His father is a doc. And his mother was a nurse friend. They lived in New Orleans, and they came up to live with him until he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a sense of facing it, but also it being really sad at the same time. And,
right.
and everybody was up front and fine with me photographing it. They mm-hmm. hoped that a book would show some, you know, might show them as individuals in a way that TV and popular culture hadn't. I mean, that was kind of my hope.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you've got to take a hard picture with shadows. You can't, you know, the AIDS, the gay men's health crisis in New York jumped on me because they weren't happy enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said, how can you photograph people dying? That's against what was, you know, what you should be showing.
Right.
And I mean, I can see they had a point. If one of my sweethearts was dying, I might only like to see happy pictures too. But that's what they want. And I mean, I said, okay, you should do that, but that's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing people who are dying over a couple of years, and I don't see any reason not to show it because it's true and it's sad and it's part of life. Mm-hmm. It's like our plague that we have to deal with.
Right. I do like these last two because there is, you know, an element of
a bit of a smile on her, a defiance.
Oh, yeah.
A defiance that, yeah, you know.
And this is...
Here, there's a story about her. Oh, you want me to tell a story about her?
Yes.
She was really a man, but she dressed like a woman. And we did everything she could. She'd taken hormones, and she was almost all the way. She had breasts and felt like a woman from the time she was born. And when you go in a room with them, she's absolutely a woman. Mm-hmm. In fact, she's smiling because she knows she has woman power over me, mm-hmm. and she knows she has woman power over this guy.
Uh-huh.
It's just part of her force, you know? And so she liked being sick and still having that kind of presence. And we did everything we could to, you know, find a doc who'd cut her penis off, but nobody would. Mm. Now I'd know better places to look, but that's what she wanted before she died. And she didn't get it.
This is one of my favorite ones, only because it's like,
you know, it's like he knows something I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's got this look on his face like I'm going, but I know something. And that's his power.
It's really interesting. When I photographed him at first, he didn't like the process of holding still, and he wanted me to make him look good. And so after two or three tries, I decided it wasn't working. So I called him up and said, I don't think we should do this anymore. You don't really like it, and it's no fun. So he agreed. But then 6 months later, when he started to feel worse, he called me up and he said, I'm ready now. So after that, wow. The next 6 months, he was absolutely wonderful and open. And you know, because he wasn't in denial anymore. Mm-hmm. Early on, he was going around to school groups and saying, oh, no, I'm not gay. I just made a couple of mistakes. He was kind of lying to school groups, and he wasn't facing that he was a gay young man. That's how he got it, and he probably was not going to survive. That was too hard for a 22-year-old to accept at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up a lot in, you know, 6 or 8 months.
And then you did a whole bunch of photographs of your family.
Mm-hmm.
Which has always impressed me too, that, you know, artists talk about taking art from life, but often they don't, you know, and because their family is the closest thing to them. But it's hard to make art from your family, but you have managed to do it. This is a great shot of Bibi, I assume, with one of your children.
Yeah, Clementine.
And, you know, it's like this. It's, I don't know how you got this photo, but it's like the baby's like going baby power, or it's like the, you know, it's like the E-Trade baby. That's probably the beginning of the E-Trade baby.
I don't know how, you know, I wanted the picture badly.
You had to be fast to get this.
I wanted the picture, you know, and I also was a little ruthless. I could see them as a subject for an instant, not as my family, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think most people's family pictures are so, you know, so boring to other people because they're just seeing it in their own context. For some perverse reason, sickness, ruthlessness on my part, I can do both. I can see them as a subject, and I can also see them as my wonderful family. And mm-hmm. that's why I was able to use my regular approach and make them. These pictures and the Brown sisters in my life are what subsidized pictures of AIDS and pictures of patients and all the hard pictures because, you know, they aren't real popular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But family pictures are. Everybody likes them, and I'm terribly grateful.
And you do the most cliched picture. That's uh-huh. and make them good.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is such a great cliche. It's amazing that there aren't more photographs in the world of things like this, of the little girl. Is this doing Bibi's hair?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. And it's like, I just go, oh, yeah, I remember that. My daughter did that.
Uh-huh.
With my wife. Everybody probably remembers this image. And then, like, getting the soap out of his eye from the... I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant, but it's a cliche. And that's a thin edge, isn't it?
That's what's kind of fun. That's the risk.
It is a risk.
Yeah.
And I just think it's great.
Thank you. Well, it's wonderful to be able to do it. You know, I had to stop with the kids when they got to be old enough to... you know, not want to do it if they didn't want to do it. So I think we stopped when they were about 8 and 10 or something, because they needed to have their own. You know, when they're little, they don't have any choice.
Right.
You know, and they pretty much loved it, so it didn't matter. I mean, they loved it.
Now, these are two photographs that I have purposely put together. They're not one photograph. So that is on the left, one of your children.
Mm-hmm. Clementine.
And then I don't know who this is on the right. I just wanted to compare this, you know, a very young eye with a very old eye. The fact that you had focused in different time periods on that part of the body, you know.
The pictures that I see, the next couple you have are of old people that I did right after the front porch pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason was it was hard. The subject was hard. It was unpromising. I mean, it was kind of difficult to make it beautiful. The place was a public nursing home that was crummy. And there was also the art problem of a single figure instead of a complicated mix of people like I'd been doing before. So I was kind of in new territory and trying to figure out how to do it. I'm going to tell you a story about this picture. It looks like he's sad and, you know, feels bad that he's in a nursing home and he's going to die and stuff. But in practice, he was a guy I knew pretty well at the nursing home. I had been a volunteer for this nursing home before I photographed. And even in the beginning said I would never photograph there because I wanted there to be one thing of my life that was free from my prey. But after a year...